So we are doing a short course this time, only 6 weeks, but it's going to take us all over the country. So let's first get into our sharing here and see what we want to see. Okay, so we are going to be talking about Bate Knesset, synagogues in the land of Israel. Both in a historical sense, we're going to take a look, especially today, next time as well, at kind of the development of the synagogue and the styles and the chronology, and we're going to take a look at that. But not only, we're going to look at other issues as well, and each time we're going to address one or two of these issues. For example, imagery, right? Pictures in a synagogue. Dedications, who gives the money and how do we remember them? Women in the synagogue, right? Always a good hot topic. So a lot of different things that are going to come up as we go along. And we're going to be addressing a little bit about prayer also, prayer at graves, different things like that. Today, we are going to take a look at a very, very significant idea, which is, as I wrote here, from temple to synagogue. What happens and when? We'll address perhaps when, not necessarily getting a very good answer, but at what point do we move from this idea of hamakom, right? One place, the temple in Jerusalem, which, as we're going to see, was not such a successful idea, to many places, right? To all kinds of different local forms of worship while still holding on to this very monotheistic idea, to holding on to this idea of one God. What are the functions of a Beit Knesset versus the Beit HaMikdash, right? A synagogue versus a temple. Do we have evidence in archaeology of the earliest synagogues, right? Those are all different things we're going to be taking a look at. I brought for you this picture. We're going to look at this place a little bit later. Sources that we have are in the chat, by the way. They're not so many, but there are some. This picture we're going to take a look at a little bit later at this site, a little more in depth. If you can guess what it is, you get extra points. Okay, this is Gamla. And the reason I put it here, besides the fact that it's an amazing ancient synagogue and one of the earliest ones that we have, right, is that you can see that here's the wall of the city. And the synagogue is actually up against the wall, is within the wall of the city. And as we're going to see, we're going to discuss, perhaps the earliest Bate Knesset are taking the place, the function of the Shar Ha'ir, of the city gate, which is such an important place in biblical times, becomes less important in Second Temple times. Maybe this is part of that transition. Some of the things that take place at the city gate are now going to take place in the Beit Knesset. So that's something to keep in mind, and it's a great picture to start off our story with. Okay, so let's just take a look quickly at some of our themes today, right? The tension between local and centralized worship, right? We have this very significant idea that we already hear about in Sefer Devarim. God says you're going to come into the land to the makom, to the place, a place, one God, one place. And yet we're going to see that that was very hard for people to abide by, and they wanted something more local. And by Second Temple times, we're able to accommodate that demand without taking away from monotheism, right? We're going to try to answer, although I don't promise you a great answer, the question of when do we begin having Bate Knesset, having synagogues, right? What synagogues do we have while the temple is standing, okay? What synagogues do we have after the Churban, after the destruction of the temple? And then there's a little bit of an add-on at the end. Like I said, we're going to deal with different themes. The story of the Aron Kodesh, right? The place, the ark where we keep the Torah, is it movable? Is it permanent? At what point does that change, if it changes, right? So those are some of our themes of today. Okay, so let's start out with this idea that we said we have in the Torah, this ideal that there should be one place, right? And just as this concept of one God is a very revolutionary concept, one place is also a revolutionary concept. The polytheistic world, the pagan world, is very multicultural. It's very respectful. You have your gods and your temples. I have my gods and my temples. I'm going to come to your place and respect your temples. You're going to come to my place and respect my temples. God says, none of that. I am one universal God and I have one place, right? Now, in truth, it takes a long time till we get till that one place, right? Rav Yitzchak Levi from Yeshivat Haratzion has an amazing series on the Haratzion virtual Beit Midrash, where he talks about stations in the land, right? Places that we had to go to before we got to the place, Hamakom, right? We have holiness in Beit El and in Hebron and in Shechem, right? All of these are places that bring something to the mix, and we need them before we reach the temple in Jerusalem. Now, one of those places, perhaps the most important place before we get to Jerusalem, is Shiloh. I know I have at least one big Shiloh fan out there. Hello, Batya. I'm sure there are others as well. Shiloh is an astounding place. It's very, very important. It's the only place that Chazal talk about, right, as putting it into the pasuk in the Torah that says you're going to come to the menucha and the nachala, right? That's where you're going to come to your final resting place. You're going to come to the nachala in Yerushalayim, but first you're going to come to the menucha in Shiloh. And Shiloh, in fact, is a place where the Mishkan is set up. It becomes a semi-permanent site. There are digs that are going on there today. There have been digs that have been going on there for 100 years. It's a fascinating site. We are pretty sure we know where the Mishkan was located in Shiloh. Hey, and that's based on the fact that, as the Gemara says, it's semi-permanent. Batya, I'm going to ask you to save it to the end or put it in the chat if you don't mind. Thank you. I really appreciate it. I know you have so much to add. But we found walls, right? Bedrock walls that actually fit the dimensions, the width of the courtyard of the Mishkan. And so we believe that this is the correct place. Semi-permanent, right? According to the Gemara, the Mishkan sits there for 369 years, right? But it is not the final place, but it is one place. As we're going to see, it's not the only place, but it's meant to be the one place. Okay. We move on to Yerushalayim, right? Yerushalayim becomes the most important place, the place where the Mikdash is going to be built, the place where the Aron of the Ark of the Covenant is going to be brought. The beginnings of Jerusalem as the place begin with King David, right, with David HaMelech, and then added to, of course, by King Solomon, who completes the job of building the Beit HaMikdash, okay? And the idea that the Aron has to come to the city and has to stay there, and Jerusalem is going to be the permanent capital, and it is the place, and no other place is legitimate. So what are the pictures that I brought you here? Okay, this is a drawing, nice drawing, but still a drawing, of Mikdash Shlomo, of King Solomon's temple. What we know about King Solomon's temple is almost exclusively from literary sources, right? We don't have archaeology practically that goes back to King Solomon's temple, but we do have a very nice description in the Book of Kings. So we have a lot of detail, for example, the kior, right? The washing station with the cows around it, right? Yachin and Boaz, the two pillars, but we don't have archaeological evidence, right? So a lot of this is conjecture, as of course, and this is an even better picture, the picture on the right here, this is a model of Solomon's temple built by the great Swiss-German archaeologist and architect and urban planner Conrad Schick. And as you can see, it looks a little bit like a townhouse in a town in Germany, right? I don't think that the Mikdash, King Solomon's temple, looked like this. But again, we don't know if it looked like this either, like the one on the left. It's a lot of conjecture about what it looked like. Now, this idea that you bring the Mikdash to Jerusalem, and the Aron and the Mikdash are reunited. This is a very important idea that we have already in Sefer Shmuel, right? If you recall your Sefer Shmuel, you remember that the Aron is in Shiloh, in the Mishkan, and then Bnei Israel, children of Israel, are going into battle against the Plishtim, and they say to Eli the priest, let's take the Aron into battle, and they take it into battle, despite Eli's misgivings. They lose in the battle, and then the Aron is taken captive by the Philistines, and it is brought from the battle place at Afek two various Philistine cities, Ashdod, Gat, Ekron, where it wreaks havoc on those cities. And ultimately, it is returned by the Philistines. They don't want it anymore. And it's returned to Israelite territory, to Judah territory, to Beit Shemesh. But again, wreaking havoc. It's a very, very holy object. You can't just treat it any way you want. And the Aron stays in exile, right? The Mishkan in Shiloh is destroyed by the Philistines, and the Mishkan moves, the Aron moves, but they are not reunited until the temple is built in Jerusalem, right? And we have a description here of bringing the Aron to Jerusalem. It takes till the time of King David. And first he brings it, it's brought to Kiryat Yarim. And then David brings it to Jerusalem. And it's a very important, very significant moment, right? What happens here? This is the pasuk that you have here, in English and in Hebrew. And, in the source sheets, I brought it, I think, only in English. I don't remember. But in any case, you have it in Hebrew here, the PowerPoint. But you got the Melech David, Lemar, Berech, Adonai, et Beit, Oved, et Dom, et Kol Asher Lo, Barufur, Aron, Elohim, vayelech David vayal et Aron ha'Elohim mibeit Oved Edom ir David b'simcha. Right, so he does this kind of in stages. First, he wants to see if everything's okay, if God likes the fact that it's been moved. When he sees that God likes the fact that it's been moved, he decides to bring it to Jerusalem, and there's this whole crazy wild parade. Vayehi ki tzadu nosei Aron Adonai shisha tzadim vayizbach shor umeri, right? Sacrifices every six steps. U'David, and this is probably the most famous pasuk in this whole story, the David mikarker b'chol oz lifnei Adonai v'David chagur efod bad, and David is wildly dancing. He is looked down upon by his wife Michal, who's the princess, right, the daughter of King Saul. She doesn't like this, and he says, I'm not dancing, I'm dancing for God who chose me instead of your father, right? Very, very harsh thing to say, but this joy that David feels at bringing the Aron to Jerusalem is a very, very important one. This is a very important moment, even though King David is not chosen to build the Mikdash, right? God says to him, it's not up to you, it's up to your son, King Solomon, for various reasons, the most famous one being that King David is a man of war, but also because it's not time yet. They're not ready. The country is not settled, right? But even though he doesn't complete the task, he does complete this idea that the Aron must stay in Jerusalem, that this is the place and there is no other place. And how does he do that? He does it at this very important moment, one of the most terrible moments of his life, when he is running away from his son Avshalom, right, who's made a coup against him, and he's running away and he's leaving and everybody's crying, and suddenly the Kohanim come and they bring the Aron, right? And take a look at this, what we have here. V'chol ha'aretz bochim kol gadol, v'chol ha'am ovrim v'amelech ovir v'nachal kidron, v'chol ha'am ovrim al pnei derech et hamidbar, right? Everybody's leaving. They're going out to the east. They're crossing the Kidron Valley. They're going to go up the Mount of Olives. Hinei gam tzadok v'chol ha'levim iton nos'im et Aron brit ha'elohim. Vayatziku et Aron ha'elohim vayal evyatar atom kol ha'am lavor min ha'ir. They're all running after him and saying, here, 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 take the Ark of the Covenant with you. But David does not allow them to do that. Vayomar melech l'tzadok ha'shev et Aron ha'elohim ha'ir. Im imtzachem b'nei Adonai v'eshivani v'herani oto v'et naveyu. V'im ko yomar lo chafatz tibach hineni yaseli kasher tov b'einav. King says, take the Ark back. No more running, no more moving for the ark. It's finished its journey. If God wants me, he'll bring me back. But if he doesn't, that's okay. But the ark has to stay in Jerusalem. And by doing this, David essentially makes Jerusalem not only the one place, but the eternal place, right? Because no matter what the fate of the city, of the king, of the Mikdash, Jerusalem remains the center. However, okay, it doesn't really work, right? It works in the sense that we still pray towards Jerusalem and we talk about Jerusalem and we return to Jerusalem after 2,000 years. However, at the time when we have this idea of one place, it doesn't work. There is always a pull towards local worship. Does this mean idolatry? Not necessarily, right? We're going to see. It could be a form of idolatry. It could be a form of worshiping God. It could be, and it most commonly was, what we call syncretism, a mixture of the two. But whatever it was, people wanted something next door, right? And we're going to see a few different local altars, temples, both in literature as well as in archaeology, right? The picture on the right is one of a number of sites that we call Gilgal. This is actually something that was discovered by the great archaeologist Adam Zartal, who passed away a few years ago. He's most famous for excavating Mount Ebal, but he also excavated these sites that he called footprint-shaped sites. As you can see, it looks a little like a footprint, right? It's a fascinating idea. He believes that when the Torah talks about Aliyah LaRegel, right, pilgrimage, which we really think of as coming for the regel, for the holiday, or regel, walking with your feet. He says, no, no, no. There was actually sites where you walked around a foot-shaped compound, and that was part of your ritual. Whether this is true or not, there definitely are ritual sites in other places besides Jerusalem. And maybe the most ironic one is this one here on the right. As you can see, this is a very kind of a basic, a primitive, but very clearly an altar, right? You can see the four corners. And this is in a place called Givat Harel, which is literally within eyesight of Shiloh, of the tabernacle in Shiloh. You could hike it very, very easily, walk from one to the other. These people didn't even bother to walk down one hill and up the other to go to Shiloh. They had their own altar in their own backyard. People were very, very tempted by this. And we see it not just in archaeology, but we see it in our sources as well. And I only brought you a couple. The most famous ones, not the most famous, but I think the most striking ones are from the Navi Amos, right? Amos is when there is very much a temple in Jerusalem, right? He's also living at a time that there's a temple in Beit El and a temple in Dan, right? Because this is the time where the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Judah have split. And he writes about the people going to all of these places and thinking that if I check off all these places from my list, God's going to do what I want. And he lists for us various ritual places. Ka'amar Adonai lebe'i Israel, dirshuni v'chyu, seek me, says Hashem, and you will live. Va'al tidrishu beit el, va'agilgal lo tavo, uber sheva lo ta'avoru, ki agilgal galo yigle, ubeit el yiyela aven, right? Much more onomatopoetic in Hebrew than in English. Don't go to, but he gives us this list. Don't go to Beit El, and don't go to Gilgal, and don't go to Beersheba, right? All of those places are false. You think that they're going to give you some kind of atonement, some kind of expiation. It's not going to work, right? And he goes on a few prakim. So we've been talking about Amos, and how he's telling about all these various sacrificial ritual places. Okay. Now we know that at a certain point in Tanakh, there are reforms. Okay. There are kings that come along and say enough, enough with this, all these different temples, all these different altars, whether they are for God or for the Baal or some combination, right? The most famous religious reformers, the most effective religious reformers are Chizkiyahu, right? And that's the pasuk you have here. Bishnat Shalosh Loshea ben Elam el Chisrael Malach Chizkiyahu ben Achaz Melch Yehuda. Right? And it tells us his mother and everything else. Vayas hayashar b'nei Adonai k'kol asher asa David aviv. Right? He's very righteous. And most importantly, who he sear at Habamot. Right? Who he sear at Habamot. Vishiber tamatzevot, vikaratata ashera, vikitate nachacha nechosher ashera sa Moshe, right? He gets rid of all of these things, all of these shrines and altars and everything else, right? It doesn't really last because a few generations later, his great grandson Yoshiyahu has to come along and do the same thing. So we have these religious reforms. There is a lot of worship of other gods, even in Jerusalem, right? A lot of worship in other places, like I said. We're going to look at two different case studies of this story. And like I said before, unclear, is this always idolatry, right? We definitely have idolatry. We have the story of Eliyahu and the prophets of the Baal, right? And we have all the people who worship the Baal. But these altars are not necessarily or only for idolatry. So we're going to look at two places. One is called Tel Sheba, okay, and one is called Tel Arad, right near the Arad of today. Okay, it is not a coincidence that both of these places are essentially on the southern border of Eretz Yisrael in the time of Tanakh. These places are far away. They are far from the center. They are far from Jerusalem. You've got people who are stationed out here who are feeling very disconnected, right? And they want to connect. And how do you connect? You make your own temple. You make your own altar. Okay, so we're going to look at both of them. First of all, Tel Sheva, which, by the way, we say Tel Sheva and not Tel Be'er Sheva, because as we're going to see, it's very likely that this is not ancient Be'er Sheva, but rather another place known as Tel Sheva. Tanakh, Sefer Yoshua talks about two sites, Sheva and Be'er Sheva. So it's very likely that this is not the original Be'er Sheva. Tel Sheva, very, very interesting place, slightly to the east of modern Be'er Sheva, a very small but very well-planned city, okay? It's got, it's a walled city. It's got a casemate wall. That means that you have houses within the wall so that you protect the city very well. It has water systems. It has storehouses. It's not a particularly big place. It's probably for about 400 people. It was an administrative center at the height of Bayit Sheni times, particularly in the 8th century, in the time of King Hezekiah. Okay? It's in a very good location. Like we said, it's on the southern border, important roads, right? It's at the beginning of what we call the Path of the Patriarchs, Derech Ha'avot. Okay? It's at the conjunction of two major rivers, water sources. So it's very fertile. Okay? It was excavated in the 60s and 70s and then again in the 90s, and it even got the dubious designation of being a UNESCO World Heritage Center, okay? Because it's such a classic first temple time period city. What it is probably and almost definitely not is the Be'er Sheva of the patriarchs. Why do we say this with so much confidence? Because we do not have a layer of the site from the time of the Avot, okay? We have early prehistoric layers, but then we don't have a settlement until the 12th century, meaning give or take the time of Yoshua. We do not have a settlement from the time of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So it's a very interesting question. Where is the Be'er Sheva of Abraham? We are not going to deal with that question, but it is interesting to think about. But like I said, this is very likely not Be'er Sheva, but Sheva, okay? We have a small settlement in the 12th century. By the 10th century, it's walled, and it reaches its height in the 9th and the 8th century when it becomes this administrative center. What we want to talk about is an altar that's put into Gniza. It's actually, we get to see the story of Chizkiyahu's religious reform in action, which is an amazing thing. And then the city is destroyed, probably by the Assyrians, by Sancheriv. So we can really date this reform very clearly. What you see in the picture is one of the two water sources of the city. One is a major water system inside the city. This is a large well. The trough is reconstructed, but there was such a thing here. But the well is the original well that goes back to the 10th century. It is incredibly deep for that time period. It's 70 meters deep, right? Over 200 feet deep. Can you imagine digging such a thing until they reached groundwater? It's outside the gates of the city for use by travelers or for use in peacetime. There's another water system inside the city. Okay, so this is a very well-developed city on the border. That's why you have an administrative center here. It's a place for defense, for collecting taxes. There's a whole setup of storehouses here. There is a classic four-room houses, the houses of that time period of First Temple times. There are about 75 houses here. It's really actually a really well-done city. It's got gates. It's got a water system. Hey, this is, we saw the wall by the outer gate. This is an inner gate with chambers, a water system that it collects the runoff from the Hebron riverbed. Okay? But most important for our purposes is there's a beautiful, perfect altar. Now today, when you come into the site, You can see a reconstruction of this altar. The real one, the authentic one, is in the Israel Museum, okay, at the entrance into the archaeology wing. And what you can see about it is that you can see very nicely, this is the real one on the left here. You can see that it's got these real stones, right? But it's also got fill because there are parts of it that we didn't find. And when I say find, what do I mean? I mean that when they were excavating here in the basement of one of the houses, they found the pieces of this altar. It had been dismantled. It had been taken apart and put into Gniza, which is a fascinating thing, right? What's going on here? Here is this altar that was built by the people of the town. It looks more or less like the altar from the temple, right? I say more or less because it has a few things that are glaringly wrong about it. Most importantly, the stones are what we call avnegazit, hewn stones. The Torah says when you make your altar, you have to use field stones, stones that are not cut by metal. These are very nicely cut by metal, not allowed to do that. Okay. You have four corners, but these corners are very rounded. They are very, they're very zoomorphic. I think that's the right word, right? They are meant to look like animals. The Mizbeach, the altar in the temple, does not look like that. And perhaps most fascinating, it has this great design over here, which looks like a snake. Okay, remember the Nachash, Nechushtan, that we just read about two slides ago about Chizkiyahu getting rid of it. Okay, they drew a snake on their altar. Maybe they assigned some holiness to this snake. So you have an altar that's sort of like the altar in the temple, but not exactly. And what happens? Along come Hezekiah's supervisors, and they're coming to every town, as it tells us in the Book of Kings and in the Book of Chronicles, and they're knocking on the gates and they're saying, got any altars here? You got any temples here? And the people in the town say, well, yeah, maybe. And they say, okay, we'll be back in a month to make sure that you've gotten rid of it. What happens? The people in the town are very disturbed by this. They don't want to get rid of it. This is a holy thing. It's very holy to them. Whether they worship God or idols or some combination of the two, this is a holy thing. So they don't get rid of it. What do you do with something holy that you can't have around anymore for whatever reason? You bury it. We call it today Gniza, right? They put it into Gniza. So this is a fascinating example of this reform process. First of all, the local worship, and second, the reform at work. Okay. We have an even better story a little bit to the east in Tel Arad, another border city. Okay. Tel Arad is a very interesting city because it's really two cities. At the bottom of the Tel is a very large, very important Canaanite city, okay, that's a trade center, that you look at it out in the middle of the desert, you say, really, this was an important city, but it really was an important city. And then it kind of just disappears. And then over 1,000 years later, along come the Israelites, and they make this border fortress here. And you have, it's a very important place. So it's protecting the road, it's protecting the border. And already from the time of King Solomon, you have fortress after fortress. Uzziah builds it up, right? You have more and more fortresses. But what do you have here? Okay. And this fortress lasts pretty much until destruction of the first temple. Okay? And we actually have a very famous writing from here, the Arad Astraka. But again, what's important for us? We have not only an altar, we have an entire temple that's put into Gniza. And the same story happens. Now, it's a question among archaeologists. Is this the time period of Chizkiyahu? Is it the time period of Yoshiyahu, of Josiah, a couple of a century or so later? Unclear. But here, they go one step further. They don't take apart the altar. They take the entire thing, because it's not just an altar, it's actually in a complete temple, and they cover up the whole thing. And by doing so, they preserve it perfectly for us to find 2,700 or 2,600 years later, right? So what did they build here in Arad? Amazing thing, okay? First of all, a perfect Mizbeach, okay? Why do I say perfect? It really is the way it's supposed to look. It's made out of field stones. It's got dirt in the middle, right? Torah talks about a Mizbeach Adama, stones on the outside, dirt on the inside. It's got a piece of flint on the top so that the blood doesn't get absorbed, right, into the dirt. It's got bones of kosher animals nearby. So we've got, and it's the perfect dimensions. It's the dimension of the altar in the Mishkan. 5 amot by 5 amot by 3 amot high. Okay. But not only that, it's here to the west, right? You have an east-west orientation, and to the west of the altar, you have the rest of the temple. It's a mini version of the temple in Jerusalem. You have the holy, okay, over here. And then further in, you have, and that's what you see in the picture on the left, the Holy of Holies. Okay. Well, actually, it's not true. You have the Heichal, you have like the inner courtyard, and then you have the Holy and the Holy of Holies over here. The Holy with incense altars, 1, 2 incense altars. And as you go up the steps, you come into the inner sanctum. You have something that you don't have in the temple in Jerusalem, and that's 2 matzevot. 1, 2. Are they meant to represent God and God's consort, which we've had inscriptions that talk about such a thing? Who knows, right? We really don't know what or how they worshiped here, but we do know that they built themselves a perfect mini temple out here in the middle of nowhere. By the way, recent analysis of what they found here shows that they actually burnt on the Mizbeach HaKtoret, on the incense altar, they burnt marijuana, which is fascinating in and of itself. Okay. But what's going on here, right? Why are they building this here? So what makes sense is you have soldiers who are posted out here to this border fortress. It's far away. They're far away from home. They're far away from their families. They're in a dangerous position. What do you do when you're homesick and you're scared and you're lonely? You want to pray, but you need a place to pray at. And so they build themselves this local temple, right? And this is what's going on throughout First Temple times, okay? There is this constant tension between the need to have one place and the desire to have many places, okay? Now, all of this comes to a very dramatic end when the temple is destroyed, okay? But that doesn't answer the question of when do we have this idea of synagogues, right? Synagogues, which are sort of the kosher answer, let's put it that way, to a need for local worship, because a synagogue doesn't have sacrifices. Only a temple has sacrifices. So you can have something local that doesn't go against the idea of only one makom, only one place. So when does this happen? So scholars of the development of the synagogue, first of all, we have literature that talks about synagogues. We have literature that talks about it in late Second Temple times. We'll come to that in a moment. Okay. But scholars of the synagogue say, well, there has to be some kind of crisis, right? That creates a synagogue, that creates this new idea. What are our crises? What are our possibilities? So probably the one that's most familiar to people, I think, is this one, right? The exile to Babylonia. And in fact, many of us are familiar with what it says in the book of Jeremiah, right? Where he says to the exiles in Babylonia, you should settle in, you should start to, you know, build yourselves houses, you should pray for the peace of the place where you are, meaning don't think you're going back to Jerusalem anytime soon. So some people take that as an indication that synagogues are beginning. And in fact, the contemporary of Jeremiah of Yirmiyahu is Yechezkel, Ezekiel, who talks about a mikdash me'at, a small sanctuary, a mini sanctuary. So some people say when we go to Babylonia, that's when synagogues begin. Other people say, no, put it back a little bit earlier when Josiah is going around creating all these reforms. Maybe that's the push to have synagogues. Other people say, no, not in Josiah's time, not in Babylonia, only when we come back to the land with Shivat Zion, with the return to Zion. Ezra and Nehemiah, we know, at least according to the rabbis, this is when we have a regular Torah reading, right? Monday, Thursday, Shabbat Torah reading. So when we have the beginnings of organized prayer, maybe it starts then, right? Other people say, no, it's the crisis of Hellenism, right? And then finally, the latest theory is not till the time of the Hasmoneans. They come along, they get rid of the Hellenists, and they say, let's have synagogues. Professor Yisrael Levine, Lee Levine, who is one of the great scholars of the synagogue, says all of these approaches are incorrect. You don't need to look for an event, a crisis. The development of the synagogue is a process. It's something that happens little by little, and it's perhaps something that begins with this evolution, like we said at the very beginning, of the city gate, right? Once the city gate is no longer the center for the judges and for commerce and for ritual, maybe then we start to have a development of a new place that's going to fulfill some of those functions. And that's the slow process of beginning the synagogue. And again, we don't have concrete proof, right? The first evidence that we have some literary evidence and we have some archaeological evidence, and none of it is before the first century before the Common Era. That's the first time we start to really hear about this. Okay, so very, very well-known inscription discovered in the city of David. It's called the Theodotus inscription, and it's the first time, not the first time, but it's the first time we hear about a functionary called the Archisynagogos, who we know better as the God. Right. This is found in Ir David, in the city of David. It was found by a Jewish archaeologist named Raymond Weil in the beginning of the 20th century. And he found this inscription written very nicely in Greek, as you can see. And it says, Theodotus, son of Vetinus, priest and head of the synagogue, or as it says in Greek, the Archisynagogos, the son of an Archisynagogos, the grandson of an Archisynagogos. Okay, so here we have this inscription from the first century based on the style of the Greek that talks about at least three generations of guys who ran the synagogue. Now, clearly this is a synagogue and not a temple. We're three steps away from the Beit HaMikdash, right? This is contemporary with the second temple. Then this is a place where people come to do something else. Now, what are they doing? That's the importance of the second part of the inscription. Built the synagogue for the reading of the law. Okay, this is where you sit and you read the Torah. The teaching of the commandments. You sit and learn Torah. A guest room. It's where your people come to stay, right? It's like a motel. The chambers and water fittings as an inn for those in need from abroad. Okay, what are we doing here? We're learning, we're reading, we're hosting people, we have water. This sounds a lot like what we would call, at least in North America, a JCC, right? Or in Israel, a matnas, right? This is a community center. What's missing here? Prayer. Okay, and we're going to talk a little about that next time. Okay, when do people begin to pray? Right, I'll just answer. Bina says, why are we calling this a gabbai and not a head of the community? Because he's the head of the synagogue, right? He runs things in the synagogue. Does that mean he's the head of the local community? Maybe. Maybe gabbai is a little bit of an exaggeration, but he seems to be the guy running the stuff in the synagogue, and the stuff in the synagogue does not seem to include prayer. Okay. It includes lots of other things, but it doesn't seem to include prayer. Hey, we also hear about synagogues in the Tosefta, right? Tosefta, more or less contemporary with the Mishnah, but could have been declaimed or said orally much, much earlier. And this is a testimony we have from Rabbi Yoshua, who is one of the early Tanaim, who lives in the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, right? Rabbi Yoshua ben Chananya says in the Tosefta and Sukkah, I didn't bring you a translation, sorry. Kol Yimei, Simchat Beit HaShoeva, right? During the intermediate days of Sukkot, we have Simchat Beit HaShoeva. We have the festival of the water drawing. Lo Hayinu Ro'im Sheinawi. We would not sleep at all. We're all partying all the time. Mashkimim Anu L'Tamid Shel Shachar. We would wake up early to give the sacrifices in the temple. Misham LeBeit HaKnesset. From there, we would go to the synagogue. What are they doing in the synagogue? He doesn't tell us. Misham LeBeit HaMidrash. And from there, we're going to the Beit HaMidrash, to the study hall. So are they doing something else, right? We're going to talk, somebody wrote here, synagogue means gathering place. Next time we're going to talk about synagogue versus prayer place, right? And that's a good point, but I'm deliberately not going into it here. It's a difference between the diaspora and Eretz Yisrael, okay? Beit HaKnesset, a kinus, as opposed to a prosuch, a prayer place. Okay, finally, we have the Tosefta and Sukkah, right? Rabbi Yehuda says, whoever has not seen the synagogue of Alexandria has never seen this the glory of Israel. And here we do have some form of prayer going on. First of all, you have this incredible exaggeration about how big it is, right? Porches within porches, double the number of those that followed Moses from Egypt, golden chairs, golden elders, amazing, right? But here, go on. In the center was a wooden dais, and the sexton stood upon it with a flag in his hand. At the close of each benediction, he waved the flag, and all the people answered amen, right? They didn't have microphones. How do you know what's going on? You have to see the flag, right? And the other thing that's very nice here, the people were not seated together, the goldsmiths by themselves, the blacksmiths by themselves, the embroiderers by themselves, so that when a poor man came in, he joined his fellow tradesmen, right? It's a beautiful idea. You have a Landsmannschaft, but according to trades, not according to cities, right? You would find where to go. And in this way, he was enabled to obtain a means of livelihood. So here already we have a description that sounds much more like our synagogues, where people are sitting, where they're praying, right? Like I said, we'll talk about the difference between diaspora and Eretz Yisrael next time. But I just wanted to point out that we have literary mentions about the Beit Knesset or a synagogue already in Second Temple times. Okay, what about physical evidence, right? So we are going to look at two different communities that have synagogues before the time period of the destruction of the temple, right? And this is a constantly evolving topic because we are always finding new things. At the moment, two of the oldest synagogues in the land of Israel are two that we're going to talk about today, Gamla and Migdal. Migdal we'll talk more about tomorrow and next time, but we'll mention it a little bit now. Okay, Gamla, right? So where is Gamla? Gamla is in the Golan, in the center to lower part of the Golan. Here we are, right? So on the eastern side of the Kinneret, on this great hill, which of course is shaped like a camel's hump. And that's how it's described in Josephus. And it's rediscovered only after the Six-Day War, when Shmariahu Gutman and other archaeologists are doing the survey of the Golan, and they come across this crazy mountain. Of course, all the stuff was not exposed yet. And they say, wow, this looks a lot like what Josephus is describing. Maybe this is Gamla. And then they start to dig, and of course, they find all this amazing stuff. Gamla was a Jewish town, a Jewish community already from Hasmonean times, up until the time of the Great Revolt, where they take part in the revolt against the Romans, in the year 67, of the Common Era, and they are completely destroyed. Okay? Again, we'll come back to the story of Gamla also a little bit later, but let's look at the synagogue for a moment. So if you look back actually for a second, you'll see what we saw in the first picture, which is that the synagogue is in the wall, right? Shmaiah Gutman tells the story about how when they first started to think that maybe this was really the site, he's with his team and they go down the hill and he says, okay, let's look for coins. Whoever finds a coin first, you know, you're the winner. And immediately they found a coin, and it was one of 6,000 coins that they were eventually going to find at the site. And they start to find the foundations of the wall. And then they have to decide where to dig. And they decide to dig at what looks like a nicer part of the wall. And it happens to be that they chose to dig. They chose very wisely. And they dug up the synagogue. That was really the first thing that they found. We can date the synagogue, right? We know it's a synagogue based on its architecture. These benches all around, pillars in the middle. We're going to see there's a mikvah right nearby. Okay. And we can date the synagogue based on the coins that are found right there. And these are coins of the Hasmonean king, Alexander Yanai, one of the last of the Hasmonean kings, who ruled from 103 to 76 BCE, meaning this Beit Knesset dates back to the first century before the Common Era. It is a very old Beit Knesset. And like I said, we have a lot of proof that not only is this a Beit Knesset, there's a mikvah right nearby, but that the town itself was very careful about halakha. It's one of the few places where we actually find, and it's very exciting for anybody who has learned the halachot of Erevin. It's one of the few places where we've actually found what is called a lechi, right? An extra pillar next to the gate of a street, right? The entryway to a street. And this is how you make an Eruv. One of the ways you make an Eruv is with a lechi. And it's been found in Gamla. So we really get a sense of a town that is following halacha, and that built the synagogue. It's going to be destroyed in the Great Revolt. That's a separate story that we will come to later. But let's mention for a minute the other important synagogue. And like I said, we'll come back to this next time more, but it's important to know about. And that's Migdal. Okay. Migdal, on the other side of the Kinneret, just a little bit north of Tveria. And about 15 years ago, an ancient synagogue was discovered there. And it's a synagogue that dates back also to the first century before the Common Era. An amazing thing, not a particularly big synagogue, but also with the benches, with the pillars, with beautiful mosaics. And we will discuss more about it. But I'll just mention that only recently, like very recently, like within this year, they discovered a second early synagogue in Migdal. So, like I said, it's very much a developing topic. But let's move on to what are probably the most famous of the early synagogues, and those are the synagogues from the time of the Great Revolt against the Romans. Okay, and we've got two here, and we will take a look at them. Right, we've got one Herodian, and we have got one down here. Why is it not on my map? I don't know, but right down here by Masada. Okay, and these are two synagogues that are built in Herod's fortresses. Herod doesn't build them. They are built by the next occupants of the site, by the zealots, in the time of the Great Revolt. Okay. I saw someone asked about orientation of synagogues. We will come back to that towards the end. And if we don't, remind me and I'll talk about it next time. Okay. But these are synagogues that are, And we'll do one more, which is a disputed synagogue. And that's the synagogue by Jericho. Okay. And that's not from the time of the revolt, but it is in the same place. So I stuck it in here also. So we'll talk about that. That one is disputed by archaeologists. There's an amazing Hasmonean and then Herodian winter palace on the outskirts of Jericho by Wadi Keld. Very, very beautiful, very impressive. Ehud Netzer, who excavated there, discovered a building with benches that he claimed was a Hasmonean synagogue for the workers, perhaps. It's disputed. It's not accepted by everybody that this is really a synagogue. If it is, it would definitely be one of the earliest. Okay? But we are going to go to our story of the zealots. Now, many people here are familiar with the story of Masada. Fewer are familiar with the story of Herodian. But these are both fabulous fortresses built by Herod, okay, both as incredible showpieces, right, to show how he could take nature and change it to his whims, but also as fortresses on the edge of the desert. And he builds these incredible places, but even Herod doesn't live forever. And about 70 years after he dies, the Jewish zealots fighting against the Romans also find these to be very good defensive fortresses, and they take over both Herodian and Masada. Masada is most famous because it's the last stand of the zealots against the Romans in the year 73. But Herodian also is a fortress that's taken over by the zealots. And they, of course, make certain renovations to Herod's palaces. Herod doesn't build synagogues. That's not important for him. But the zealots do want to have synagogues. And again, probably more as gathering places. The synagogue in Masada, very famous. How do we identify it as a synagogue? Again, the architecture, okay, the benches, the pillars. But here, as we're going to see in a moment, there's also a geniza. Okay, there's also text, not a geniza like we were talking about before with the altars, but a geniza for texts that were buried in the walls and next door to the synagogue. Today, I just brought this picture because it's so amazing, right? In the synagogue where the zealots listen to Elazar ben Yair's speech, where he talks about how we are the last Jews. Today, there is a Chabad sofer who comes every day from Kiryat Gat and is writing a Sefer Torah, which is just a beautiful thing. But we do have a geniza. We have texts that date back to Second Temple times that were discovered in the synagogue and in the room next door. Okay, texts from Devarim, from Vayikra, from Bereishit, from Yechezkel, okay? Plus texts that are not Torah texts, from the book of Ben Sira, from various hymns, right? So it's fascinating to find these here. Remember that the zealots who come to Masada are coming already at the beginning of the war. They're coming already in the year 66. They stay there till 73. So we have a very long time that Masada is inhabited. Herodian, a little less well known. All right. Herodian is a little less well known, but it's also such an important site on the edge of the Judean desert, eastern part of Gush Etzion. Very, very impressive palace that Herod builds, perhaps even more impressive than Masada. And the same thing, the Zealots come here, they take over, they make a synagogue, and you're already getting the sense of how these synagogues were all designed. This one has a less famous end. We don't really have this standoff between the Zealots and the Romans that we have at Masada. At some point, they're either defeated or chased away or just run away, but it's also one of these Zealot, great revolt synagogues. Now what's fascinating is we have a gap. As we're going to see next time, we have many synagogues from the fourth century and on, and they're some of the most important synagogues in the Galilee. We have all these synagogues from before the destruction and during the destruction of the temple, but we have a missing link. We don't seem to have synagogues from the destruction of the temple in the year 70 till the beginning of the fourth century in the year 300. And the question is why, right? We're going to talk about two possible candidates for very early synagogues next time. And that's this one in Kfar Nachum here on the left, and this one in Chukok or maybe in Wadi Hammam, right? But still, nothing compared to what we have later in the fourth century and on. And the question is why, right? There are various suggestions. And again, it could very well be that we just haven't found them yet because we're finding so many things. But the suggestions of why we would not have such things, number one, perhaps in the course of the Bar Kokhba revolt, in the terrible defeat of the Jews by the Romans, maybe synagogues were destroyed. Okay. Another suggestion is maybe Jews were kind of underground, that they didn't want to be in the face of the Romans, and therefore they prayed in private homes, in shtiblach, right, like we would call them today. And what perhaps is the most logical suggestion is that there were synagogues, but they were renovated and made into newer and more beautiful synagogues later, leaving no trace of the earlier ones. All different interesting suggestions. Okay, so for the final thing we're going to do, and I appreciate everybody's indulgence. I'm sorry we're going over time. But the last thing we're going to do is talk a little about the Aron Kodesh. Now, this relates to that question that somebody wrote before, what's the orientation of synagogues? So we are very used to this idea. People who don't know a little less will say synagogues are always facing east, right? If you know a little more, you know they're not facing east, they're facing Jerusalem, right? So wherever you live, wherever Jerusalem is, that's the direction that you're facing. But if you've been to enough synagogues around Eretz Israel, ancient synagogues, you know that not always are they oriented towards Jerusalem. And this is a process, and sometimes it depends on topography, and sometimes it depends on, do you want people to come into the synagogue and be facing the congregation or be able to sneak in from the back, right? But one of the things that we often see is the orientation of the synagogue is based on the fact that there's a special niche for the Aron Kodesh, right? And if the Aron Kodesh has a permanent place, then the orientation is going to be towards that place, right? And again, later synagogues do have that orientation towards Yerushalayim. But the question is, was there always a permanent Aron Kodesh, right? So that's the very interesting question. We have early sources that seem to indicate that this is not the case, that not only is there not a permanent Aron Kodesh, but that a Sefer Torah is not always in the Beit Knesset. So we'll start with this great picture, right? This is a stone carving that was found in Kfar Nachum, in the area that we're going to talk about next week when we talk about northern synagogues. You've heard of Meals on Wheels. This is Aron Kodesh on wheels, right? You could see it really nicely. Here you have some kind of a sanctuary or perhaps an Aron. I mean, you have the picture of the Aron. This is clearly an Aron over here, right? And you have wheels. You have a wagon. Why are we carrying the Aron around? Perhaps it's a depiction of the story we have in Sefer Shmuel of returning the Aron, right, from the Plishtim when it's on a wagon. That's very possible. But perhaps it's a depiction of what they had, which was an Aron that was moved from place to place. Now, why do we think that such a thing was true? We have some very interesting sources. So take a look at the source you have here in Erevin. When Rav Dimi came from Eretz Yisrael to Babylonia, he said it once happened that the people forgot and did not bring a Torah scroll to the synagogue on Friday while it was still day, which meant they were left without a scroll from which to read on Shabbat. You had to bring the scroll to the Beit Knesset before Shabbos. Why? Why isn't the scroll there? Who knows? Maybe they didn't keep it there. Maybe it wasn't safe. Maybe it was kept in someone's house. On the following day, Shabbat, they spread a sheet over the pillars positioned between the house where the scroll was kept in the synagogue, forming a corridor, right? This is an issue of carrying. Are you allowed to carry it? How can you carry it? That's not our issue. That's not what's important to us here. But what's important to us here is why is the Torah scroll not in the Beit Knesset? It's not in the Beit Knesset because the Aron was not permanent. And an even better source, right? We hear about this in the Gemara and Tanit, where we know that on fast days, you want to have everybody gathering, as many people as possible. You want it to be in a public space, both for the numbers and because this way everyone will see. And what did you do? And this is the beginning of the second chapter of the Mishnah in Tanit. They take the ark out to the open space of the city. In Hebrew, it's called Rechova Shel Ir. Okay, now this doesn't mean that the ark was not in the Beit Knesset, but it does mean that the ark could be moved from place to place. So at some point in the history of the Beit Knesset, the Aron stops being movable. It becomes permanent. Okay. And we see this in decorations in the Batei Knesset, right? You have Aronot Kodesh that are in the mosaics. And we even have a super fancy, Aron Kodesh, or what's called a Hechalit is the technical term. This is in a synagogue that we're going to take a look at in the last class of the series, a place called Umel Kanatir in the Golan. And there's this incredible, elaborately decorated stone carvings and a staircase that you go up to, and all of this for a permanent Aron Kodesh. So at some point, this changes from one to the other. So that's just a very interesting little side point about the furniture of the Beit Knesset. Next time, we are going to go up north, and we're going to look at different Batei Knesset in the north, and at the story of mosaics, and imagery, and evolution, chronology of synagogues. Thank you, everybody. I apologize for our glitches. Hopefully, Chevrat Chashmal will be on my side in the future. Let's see what questions we have here. Hold on. Let me stop the sharing. Okay. Okay. Synagogue, right. Like I said, we're going to talk about that to gather together. Orientation we talked about. Are those Torah texts consistent with ours? So that's getting into the question of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Mostly yes. I will say mostly yes. Not 100%. We do have different texts and different Masorah. But, you know, nothing too earth-shattering. It doesn't say in one of them.
My question was about the ones that were found at Masada. Were they consistent?
Masada also, it's a good question. Are they exactly like what we have? I don't know if it's, you know, there could be like changes, kriyuktiv, malei chaser, but basically the same content. Let's put it that way, right? Maybe the spelling is a little bit different. That's usually the differences that we have. But I could look in Yigael Yadin's book and find some more. Will the presentation be available in video? I assume that it will be. Yes. And I, as I have explained before, I very much apologize, but the first 25 years of my life I spent in New York, and now I'm here, so I can't speak slower. It's congenitally impossible. Was there a Beit Knesset in Qumran? Okay, very interesting question. There are suggestions that there was a place that they prayed, but again, not so conclusive. And there are other places, by the way. There's a place called El Umdan by Modi'in. There are other. I didn't bring you all the early synagogues. We do have other early synagogues. We're not going to look at everything, but there are different ones. So Qumran, I have to go back and check and see. As far as I remember, it's not accepted by everybody. Other questions, other comments? Okay, thank you, everybody. Have a Shabbat Shalom. Next week, hopefully, we will be normal and go from 7 to 8 again. Thanks.
Thank you.
Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Shuli. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Shabbat shalom, Julie.
Shabbat shalom.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Have a good week.